This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We're going to begin today with new thinking about an old practice, the police interrogation. It's familiar enough thanks to popular crime shows like Law and Order and CSI. The detective slams an incriminating folder on the table and demands a confession. And it often works.
The same thing happens in real life, but sometimes with a terrible result, a false confession. False confessions are the second most common reason for wrongful convictions, and a case in point occurred just a few years ago right here in Massachusetts. Police in Worcester coerced a 16-year-old girl named Na Trong to confess that she smothered her own baby to death.
WBUR reported that story 2 years ago when we heard a recording of the interrogation.
And that's why you smothered Kyle, didn't you? That's why you smothered him, didn't you?
We'll never kill him.
Really? Because that medical examiner told me that that baby was smothered. Does that change your story?
A judge ruled that the detectives used deception and deemed that confession inadmissible. But the police were using a coercive interrogation strategy, which is a key component of the Reed technique, which has been the standard for law enforcement officials for many years. Proponents say when employed correctly, it's a tough but reliable way to compel the accused to confess to their crimes. But critics say it's coercive and often leads to false confessions, as in the case of Na Trong. Douglas Starr, co-director of the graduate program in science journalism at Boston University, writes about this in the current issue of The New Yorker in his piece, The Interview: Do Police Interrogation Techniques Produce False Confessions? He took a basic course in the Reed technique here in Boston, and he joins us now. And Douglas Starr, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thanks, Anthony.
So let's start by describing what the Reed technique is. It's named for its founder, John Reed. Tell us something about it.
Yes. John Reed was a policeman in the 40s and 50s out of Chicago. And at the time, it was common for police to use the third degree, which basically meant beating a confession out of the suspect. And Reed was a humanitarian, and he was a lie detector expert. And based on the responses he was seeing from people taking lie detection, he thought there might be a way to use conversation to get people to admit the truth.
So describe the steps of this conversation and this interrogation.
There are three basic steps to the Reed technique as it's practiced to this day. The first big step in the conversation is what they call the behavioral analysis interview. And you ask the person a series of questions, some benign, some loaded. And as with a polygraph test, the loaded questions might provoke a response. You might ask, for example, what do you think they should do to the guy that committed this crime? And you watch the person's nonverbal behavior and verbal behavior, and after that goes on for a while, you come to a decision whether or not the person is lying. Then you leave the room, you wait 5 minutes, you pick up an official-looking folder, you go in, and you stand over the person and say, "Mr. Jones, we've investigated thoroughly, and according to what we found, you indeed did commit that crime." And you're now entering the interrogation phase, in which you launch a direct accusation, and then the rest of that is funneling the person into admitting that he, in fact, committed the crime.
So go back to that information gathering phase where you basically determine that the person is lying, and they rely heavily on physical responses, right?
Yes. And the trouble is 40 years of psychological research shows that body language has absolutely nothing to do with deception. In fact, field tests have shown that police who look at a video of somebody confessing without the sound are more apt to get it wrong than those who listen to what the person says.
See, this terrifies me because I've thought about and read about wrongfully convicted people, and what I find terrifying is if I were to be hauled into a police interrogation room accused of a crime that I didn't do, I can imagine looking incredibly nervous.
Yes, and the two things they look for are, the body language and signs of anxiety. Mm. And you cause anxiety and you watch for anxiety. But the other major fallacy is anxiety has nothing to do with lying. And they've done experiments in prisons getting prisoners to lie because they're really good at it, one imagines. And again, you just can't tell. The average person has coin-flipping odds of looking at somebody and seeing if that person is lying. So you're in this situation where somebody's assessing you based on outmoded criteria, and you're about to be shot down the river.
Wow. So then let's talk about what they do in this when they start interrogating them. And I want to go back to this 2008 confession by Na Trang that we started this segment with. In that case, the cops basically, and the judge sort of confirmed this, used trickery, implied promise, they made false statements. So here's a soundbite of the detective saying untruthfully that the medical examiner told him that her child had been smothered.
Please believe me.
I don't believe you because I believe the scientists. I believe the doctors who told me that they can tell by inspecting your son's body that he was smothered.
So that was a lie. The child wasn't smothered. The medical examiner didn't tell the police officer that. Where's the line between what police can say truthfully and untruthfully in an interrogation?
According to a 1969 Supreme Court decision, there is no line. You are allowed to lie to the suspect. You know, I'm sorry, Anthony, but we found your fingerprints on the gun. What are we supposed to do with that? Wow. I actually saw a confession. It was coerced, and the detective was very gentle, very nice, and he said, young man, we have the science to detect fingerprints inside a child's vagina. And science tells us that you did this. Complete fiction.
Wow.
And the kid confessed.
Wow. So tell us about minimization. What happens during this phase called minimization?
So this interrogation part, you know, you've decided that the suspect is lying. And you do two things. One is maximization, which is you just bat away the denials. If you say, I didn't do it, I say, you know, Anthony, let's get past that. Let's not waste each other's time.
Right.
And the other thing I do is I lower the moral barrier to confession. I may say, you know, Anthony, you know, you're accused of shooting your wife. I got to tell you, my wife drives me nuts. We have such arguments. And the other night, I swear to God, if the front doorbell didn't ring, I don't know what I would have done.
Mm.
In other words, I'm making it morally acceptable for you to confess. I'm saving your dignity.
We have another example of that, again, from the Na Trang case. Let's listen to this.
You're angry, sick, tired. Sick and tired of being sick and tired. Pissed off at your mother and you did something stupid. Get help. I dare say your mother's more to blame than you are. You had zero chance of being a kid.
Boy, talk about minimization.
Classic,
right?
Classic. There's a section in the Reed manual that actually justifies rape and says, Joe, you know, no woman should have gone around dressed like that. I could totally understand why you do that. You actually blame the victim. Now, it must be said, the interrogator doesn't really feel that way.
So do we know that the Reed technique is a cause of a lot of false confessions?
Yes, it's a cause of a lot of rightful confessions. It's very effective, but there seems to be a lot of collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
We know this from a few things. One is observations in the field. I mean, scientists have studied this technique for the last 40 years the way zoologists might study a species of animals. So they do field studies in which they observe the outcomes and they look at cases that are overturned, but they also dissect it in the laboratory. And they do experiments with people on, let's pick an element of the Reed technique and see if it causes people to confess to something they didn't do. So by this way, over a period of 40 years, people have found a lot of problems with that technique.
And how widely is it used by police departments across the U.S.?
Well, since they started offering the training in the 70s, the Reed Company estimates that they've trained about 400,000 people.
Wow.
It's pretty much universal. And the other thing is one psychologist told me, if it's not Reed, it's Reed-like.
What are the folks that run the Reed technique, that stand by it, what do they say to you about your concerns?
Well, as you know, I actually took the course in addition to studying it. And then I traveled to Chicago and I spent an afternoon interviewing Joe Buckley, who's the president of Reed. And they deny it. I mean, one of the interesting things to me was I said, you know, since John Reed developed the technique and you guys have, you know, revised it over and over again, have you ever consulted with psychologists? He said, no, never. It's entirely based on experience. Well, science doesn't work like that. You have to gather data. But they tend to say whenever you get a wrongful conviction, the interrogator didn't really closely follow the Reed technique, and they can nitpick.
You know, it might be hard for a lot of people to understand why anyone who is innocent would confess to a crime he or she didn't commit. But your piece is full of examples of when this happened, how this happens, and why it happens.
Would anybody admit to a crime they didn't commit? The answer is, believe it or not, rather readily.
Hmm.
And the people that tend to admit more are those who have a naive belief in the legal system because they think, you know what, this guy's not going to believe me no matter what I say. He claims to have all sorts of evidence. I'm just going to admit it and the system will clear me. But what happens is once you make a confession, it's a row of dominoes. We are so wired to believe that confessions are true that it trumps everything.
So what's the alternative? In your piece, you describe something called the peace technique. Tell us what that is.
Yes. In the 1990s, there was a flurry of false confession scandals in Britain. And the British Home Office said, full stop, we've got to have more scientifically designed confessions. And they convened a body of psychiatrists, lawyers, police, to really come up with a scientific method of interviewing people. And they ended up calling it peace. And basically, it's a non-accusatory interview. They don't go for confessions. They gather information almost the way a journalist would.
How effective is it? Do we know?
It seems to be extremely effective because it's based on modern science. And modern psychological science says that although lying bears no relation to anxiety or body language, it does create a cognitive load, meaning the more you lie, the more balls you've got to keep in the air. So what the peace interrogators do is they don't try to be your pal. They don't try to minimize. They don't try to say, I'm on your side. They simply ask in a very objective way, and they ask for the full story, and then they go back over the story and start examining individual pieces. And I've seen videos of suspects simply fall apart under that because they can't keep the story straight. They don't go for confessions. It's just fact-finding, and according to their records, the false confession rate is extremely low.
Hmm. Well, you spoke to someone named Saul Kassin. He's a psychologist, a critic of the Reid technique, and I was intrigued by what he said because he talked about this culture of confrontation being so embedded in our society that to change these interrogation techniques is not going to be easy.
There has been some progress. I mean, for the last 35 years, he and his colleagues have been working to get change. And one of the good things is 17 states now require police to videotape confessions. And that could be very effective. But we still do have a ways to go.
That's Douglas Starr. He's co-director of the graduate program in science journalism at Boston University. You can find a link to his New Yorker piece called The Interview, Do Police Interrogation Techniques Produce False Confessions, at Radio Boston. Douglas Starr, thanks so much.
Thanks, Anthony.
Well, in a moment, we'll come back and take a look at another new tool that local law enforcement agencies are using. That's deep digital surveillance of your cell phone activities. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.